Welcome. We've been talking about the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. And so let's go to that text. Exodus 20, the first. And let's read those same verses that Mark has been reading. So starting at verse 1 in chapter 20. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle, or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not cover your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Thus says the Lord. And today we're going to talk about the commandment, thou shalt not murder. And some of this may get a little dark at times, but it's the Word of God, and it's what He has ordained. But I titled this, The Law of Life, and you're probably thinking, how in the world can you get there out of Thou Shalt Not Murder? And hopefully when I get done, that'll be clear. But that's where we want to go. And in this, as I really went through this, to me it's a message about the cross. It's a message about what Christ did in going to the cross and what he paid for on that cross for us. And keep that in mind as kind of a core principle as we go through this and talk about it. But what I want to start with, and this will probably sound even more strange, is the Titanic. And you're like, what has the Titanic got to do with Thou Shalt Not Murder? But recently there's some new evidence that was uncovered. They found some photos in an attic in England. And it's come to light that the Titanic, which sank on April 14th, 1912, there was a fire in the coal bunkers that had started several days, maybe weeks, before the ship sailed. And these pictures showed on the hull a large area about at least 30 feet long and probably 15 to 20 feet wide, a scorch mark on the outside of the hull. It clearly shows through. And even though there was a trial after the ship sank, and many of the people at the shipbuilding firm, and there were some of the men who were on the ship who did survive, and they testified, yes. And there was even one of the guys that was one of the chief stokers. The stoker is the one who's shoveling the coal into the furnaces and into the boilers. And he testified, as did others, that yes, the fire was raging and had been raging. And that mark was right where the iceberg would strike as the ship sailed across the Atlantic. Engineers at the Imperial College of London have determined the fire had to have taken place in the three-story coal bunker of the ship. Knowledge of the fire is well known, and several material witnesses were called to testify to the fact that the ship was on fire before it set sail, before it left Belfast. Coal fires, some of you may know, I mean, I've not really dealt with coal, but coal fires are extremely difficult to put out, and the only way to put it out was to put it in the furnace of the ship and burn it, since it's already on fire. In comparison, and I validated this with our local Pennsylvania resident, ex-resident, there's been a coal fire raging in Centralia, Pennsylvania. Maybe some of you had heard this. Since May 27th, 1962, and it's still burning today. And in fact, it got to the point where the federal government had to go in and buy the town and move everyone to a new location because the smoke was coming out of the ground. And it's still on fire today, 57 years later. The fire burning in the Titanic was in the bunker that was against the main bulkhead of the ship. It's estimated the fire would have reached 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which would have severely weakened the bulkhead and the hull. The workers who testified at the trial proceedings indicated the bulkhead had been significantly weakened by the fire, and some even reported that the metal in the area was buckling. As the ship pulled out a port and set sail, the stokers were shoveling coal nonstop for days, which in essence was putting the ship at full speed. So the idea of why didn't they slow down when they got to the ice field was that they couldn't. It was either full speed ahead and hope you hit nothing, or you're going down in flames. So it's now surmised that is the reason the ship was traveling full speed when it entered the ice field. When the ship struck the iceberg, the Titanic designer was on board, and he did live. And he went below decks to evaluate what was, when they hit, what did they hit, and what was the status of the ship. He did not think the ship would sink as long as the bulkheads held up. However, one of the main bulkhead was already badly damaged, and shortly after that, the main stoker, who surprisingly did survive, managed to get himself into another room and close a watertight door just as a huge, in his words, a green sea of foam came through, and minutes later the ship began to go under. Mr. Ismay, who's the owner of the White Star Line, was in huge competition with his main competitor, the Cunard Line. And in fact, to the point that he was financially almost bankrupt and he was cutting corners everywhere possible. And he had chosen to use substandard steel and he cut a lot of other corners throughout the shipbuilding process. So the whole thing was probably doomed from the beginning. And even though he knew about the fire, rather than choosing to stay and do something with it, knowing that the passengers that he had on board, the wife, Mrs. Astoria, this was a luxury liner. The Cunard Line was built for speed and more, not that standard of luxury. The White Star Line was the premier in that day and time, and that's what they were banking on. And ultimately, it cost the lives of many. And we might say that truly, Mr. Ismay was guilty of murder of thousands because of the decisions that he made to go ahead and leave port in those conditions and put everyone at risk. So that's where I was tying that in. So, thou shalt not murder. As we get into that, how do we define murder? The Hebrew word is rashak, which means to murder or slay. It's an unjustifiable killing and I should have put in there, of a human being. That has been the historic definition throughout history. The American Dictionary of the English Language, Noah Webster, wrote it in 1828. And you can still buy it. It's in print today. It's about this thick. And when you do, it's amazing the biblical references that he has throughout the English dictionary. But in 1828, he wrote, "The act of unlawfully killing a human being with premeditated malice by a person of sound mind." That was his definition. Interestingly, words change over time, right? The meanings, the words we use today, we kind of throw things around that a word that used to mean X now may mean Y, or whatever the case might be. But National Geographic, in July of 2008, ran a story regarding the killing of silverback gorillas in Africa. And the photo on the front page and the headline was, "Who murdered the mountain gorillas?" And so that word immediately took on a whole different connotation. Not who slain or who slew or slaughtered or butchered or, and I'm using some graphic terms there and apologize for that, but not using any of those words, but the editors of National Geographic decided to say, who murdered? And there's a whole, I think there's a definite intent to do that, because once you begin to change what that word means, then it has a truly impact in all of society and how society sees those events and how we react to those events. So going from there, what is the basis of the commandment, thou shalt not murder? Man is created in the image of God. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. Going on to Genesis 5, 1 through 3, this is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. And he blessed them, and he named them man in the day that they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. So what's key about those two passages? God created man in his image. Not an exact replica, but we're made in that image. Adam and Eve in the garden had a slightly different image because sin had not entered the world. But we today are still made in that same image, because after that event of sin entering into them, and they were evicted from the garden, never allowing to be returned, and Adam and his wife had a son, Eve, who bore the image of Adam, who bore the image of God. So yes, sin had entered the world and marred our image and our likeness, but it's still God's image. It's still there. That word image is the Hebrew word shalem, which means from an image. The word likeness is the Hebrew word demuth, which means likeness or similitude. So that we are made in God's image. And if he's the creator, and he loved us, we love because he first loved us, then how can murder be an option? And it can't be, because we are his creation. We were built for that relationship with him. And that's what he wanted us to do and to be and to have that relationship with him. And that Adam's son, Seth, carried that same likeness. So going on, what's the foundation of not murder? Thou shalt not murder. God's the creator of government. Romans 13, 1 through 7 is one of the classic passages of God instituting governments throughout all of time and what he intended for governments to do. God's the creator of government. Romans 13, 4, I'm using that out of that whole passage. But Romans 13, 4, it is a minister of God for or to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. That is the function of government. It's there to carry out that purpose. It's to be the protector of civil obedience and civil disobedience and to provide punishment when it's necessary. And so God has indicated, this is how I want it structured and how government should function. And granted, our government was based upon this. There's a lot of countries where that isn't the case. But God still created those governments. Government was put there by him. No one came into the role of leading a country that God didn't allow for whatever reason. And some of those are really difficult to understand when you look at some of the horrendous acts that have occurred across human history. You know, go back 20 years in Rwanda, if you know that story, and the thousands upon thousands that were just murdered, and how someone could be that brutal. And yet God allows those things to happen. It's beyond me to ask why, and that's his business. But God has created government for that purpose. God also metes out punishment. Genesis 9, 5 through 6 is a second passage where God is instituting government. Verse 5, surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast, I will require it. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. So we have that same word, image. And God is the creator. What's happening here? Noah and his family have just stepped off the boat. They're the only 8 people in existence. And they're restarting the world. And God gives this command. And it's not just a command to Noah and his wife, but it's a command for everyone that follows. This is what I require. This is how God sees, because of how we've been created and what he has intended. We are made in his image, in his likeness. Charles Ryrie states that murder shows contempt for God as well as for one's fellow man. And contempt there, I think, is in the strongest terms possible. That we're truly despising the Creator and what he intended in this relationship, in his creation. And God put man at the highest level, that we are to watch over and to rule over the birds of the sea and the cattle and even the creepy things of the earth. And as a side note, when I read that, I'm like, even the creepy things, and I'm like, the things that we think really don't matter, to God they do matter. I mean, in that whole list of, as God is giving this list of his creation, the fish and the birds and the cattle and so on, and then the creepy things that crawl upon the earth. Man is to rule over all that. And society today wants to change that. I've seen, and some of you have probably seen too, but there are those that would like to change that hierarchy, that the animal kingdom is of highest and man is of lowest because of what we're doing to the earth. You know, the climate change people and those types, that we are the destructors. And that's not what God intended. And his word says that. But his intent was that if you commit murder, this is how God sees it. So what are the methods of murder? And I don't want to get into manslaughter and homicide and those kinds of things. The Ted Bundys, the Jack the Rippers, the, you know, those that, of that nature. I mean, those things happen. Those people are depraved or mentally unstable or whatever the case might be. But let's take it from a different angle. Euthanasia. What is the word euthanasia? It's the act or practice of killing individuals who are hopelessly sick or injured for reasons of mercy. Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary of 1974. Euthanasia is not even in Noah Webster's Dictionary of 1828. The word didn't exist. There's probably people that thought about that type of thing, but from a society impact, it was not a practice that was observed. You would have been twisted to be thinking in those types of terms. But today, we throw that word around like it's no big deal. We're seeing a significant increase in the desire to use euthanasia. Oregon instituted the Death with Dignity Act in 1994. Washington followed suit 14 years later. Jack Kevorkian tried to do the same thing in Michigan a few years after that, and Michigan fought it back. But it continues to grow, and we're seeing it become more and more prevalent throughout the country. We see it in the Bible, actually. Technically, if you want to think of Saul's death as he's on his last day in the battle, and he's mortally wounded, and a young Amalekite comes by. This is in 2 Samuel 1, 1 through 16. I didn't put it up here, but you can check it out. And Saul tells him to fall upon him and take his life because he is wounded and he's afraid should the enemy find him of what they might do to him before he truly would expire. And so the young man does that. And then he puts ashes on his head and he tears his clothes and he runs and he finds David, who's interestingly living in the camp of the enemy at this time because he's fled Israel because of his fear of his life because Saul has been trying to kill him. And he approaches David and said, "I have found King Saul and Jonathan. And Jonathan was dead and I took the life because King Saul asked me to do that." And David said, "How could you raise your hand against the Lord's anointed? That is not for you to make that choice." And he told one of his men to fall on him and take his life, and he did so. So, biblically, we have a classic case of euthanasia right there. But God said, "That is not what I desire." And David took the proper action for one who committed that sin. What about a person who wants to die? And I've not been in that position. Maybe you know a person that has been terminally ill for in their extreme pain for quite some time. And just the difficulty of what they're going through. And they probably want to die. And as I say that, a guy that was our neighbor many years ago when our sons were little, Wilbur Ball, if you knew Wilbur. Wilbur grew up on a farm and on a ranch near Briggsdale. He survived the Bataan death march. One of the few that did that. And went on through the Pacific Theater in World War II. Became a college professor. Wrote a number of books. Every summer he would go on a horse ride. He would take one of the old trails and ride it. Because that was just things that he loved to do because he grew up as a cowboy. But he developed pancreatic cancer late in life. And just incredible pain and incredible agony. And yet, I never saw him without a smile on his face. Just an amazing guy. So even though he may have wanted to die, Wayne Grudem, in his book, Politics According to the Bible, said, it is morally wrong to murder a person even when a person wants to be murdered, which means wants to die. They want to kill themselves. You cannot make it morally right. I mean, think about that. God's law is thou shalt not murder. And so even in that position, you can't make it morally right in God's eyes. Go back a few years during Obama's election. And what did you see on the news? And I don't want to pick on the millennials or anyone like of that age group. And Jim's smiling back there. But what did you see? I mean, a lot of the younger people, the younger generations, the elderly people they don't deserve to live because we're using up medical resources, we're using up monetary resources, and we need those for us. And all of you that are getting this gray stuff, you need to go away because you're costing us. You saw it on the news. I saw it several times. And I'm like, really? That's where we've came to? That I'm an inhibitor to somebody's financial wealth and well-being just because of my age? What about abortion? And this is a topic that we could spend weeks on this topic. And I'm not going to cover everything. I'm just trying to cover the most salient points of what does thou shalt not murder look like and what does it mean to us from a historical perspective as well as what does it look like today. But Psalm 127:3, behold, children are a gift from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Children are a gift, and they only come as God creates. It's not just because we want. And my nephew and his wife are a classic example, and you've heard me talk about that with everything that they went through. But children are a gift from the Lord. Psalm 139, 15, and 16. My frame was not hidden from you. David's talking to God here. When I was made in secret, and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. And what's he talking about there? Your eyes have seen my unformed substance. At the point of fertilization, life, it's now been proven that life begins, and everyone here probably already knew this, but scientifically now, begins at the point of conception. And to use the scientific term, it's the gametocyte, when the sperm and the egg come together and each have been reduced to half of their chromosomes, at the point of that union, you now have 46. And so you have a complete cell with all the material that's necessary to create life. And it's at that point, there's not a heart yet. There's not a bone yet. There's not a brain. There's an unformed substance. But David says, you've seen that. And you know who I am. that you have created that. Exodus 21, the next chapter that we're going to get to. So we'll probably touch on this again, but Exodus 21, 22. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely. So think about those words. And then God goes on and gives a list of what happens. If the child comes forth and nothing, and there is no harm, then the man would pay a penalty, a fine, and go on. If the child should die, then the man who struck the woman is to die. But what does God say there? If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with, she's pregnant. What does God call that? It's a child. God calls it a child. That is the word he uses. And today we like to throw words around, a fetus, other things. And that's not what God says. It's a child. The word is yeled in Hebrew, which means child. And the word prematurely is the word yasa, which means to come forth. So the child goes forth. The child is born. And it's born prematurely, before the term of the pregnancy. But in terms of abortion, today we hear the numbers, we hear these numbers thrown around in the news all the time. Current statistics of surgically aborted children is approximately 60 million from 1975 to 2018. This next part I did not know, and it blew my mind. Children aborted by chemical means, which if you've heard the term abortifacients, RU486, other chemical-induced elements, it's probably in the neighborhood of 550 to 600 million in that same term in this nation. So when we hear about 60 million, it's a small portion. Mark 10, 14, God says, Christ says, permit the children to come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. And I think about the words where, you know, for the one who harms a child, that a millstone should be hung around their neck. God takes a very strong view of life and the antithesis of life, murder. Infanticide. This was another one that just totally shocked me. But in February of this year, Congress, the U.S. Senate, was debating a bill that children without parents should be killed. Tim Scott stood on the floor of the Senate February 25th of this year and said, it's not about being pro-child or pro-choice or pro-life, but we must be pro-child. And I never knew this took place, but last Thursday I come up out of my office in my basement, which is when I started working from home in 2008, I guess, and put my office in the basement. My wife said, you get out there and stay down there. This is my house. So that's where I stay. But I come up and she had the TV on, and Fox News is interviewing him last Thursday. And they show the clip of him standing on the floor of Congress talking about this. And I'm like, how in the world did we get here? That children without parents, we should just end their life. Just wipe them out. And to think there are those in our government that are of that mindset, and in this country as well. Does God commit murder? And this is one you have to really wrap your mind around. But immediately when I say that, what should come to mind? Ananias and Sapphira. When they approached the apostles and they secretly talked about the land that they had sold, but they kept some of it, and God took their life on the spot. Yes, he does. And we read that, Genesis 9, 5, and 6. God is delegating from this point in that verse, in those verses in Genesis 9, about human institutions and governments, of what is required of them. Capital punishment is a valid deterrent. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to pursue it. And lots of legal institutions spend millions upon millions of dollars and years and years and years of time to keep people on death row and incarcerated, because we can't do that. That's too inhumane to go to that distance. But that's not what God says. And it's not something that we have just decided. God's law says that capital punishment is a valid option. So that was the dark side of the sermon. Where do we go from there? And to try and bring us back to what I talked about in the beginning, what is the law of life? Why did God create man? Think about that. What is his purpose? Genesis 5, 1 through 2, and we've already read this. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. Did God need us? Not a chance. He was perfectly fine. The Trinity was perfectly capable. The creation was there. And I marvel, if you ever get a chance, go look up the images of the Hubble telescope. And it blows my mind, the pictures. I mean, there are whole galaxies out there that are shaped and look exactly like the human eye. And I think it's titled, Gary, help me out here, because you may know this. I think it's called the Eye Galaxy. I mean, it looks just like the human eyeball. There's the Sombrero universe. It's massive. And it's like 45 million light years away. And it looks exactly like a sombrero. There's the Horse Nebula, which is in the center of Orion's belt. And there are these horse heads. There's three of them. And they're dark green. And they're massive. And they look just like a horse head. And there's thousands and thousands of other photos. If you ever get a chance, go look up Hubble telescope photos. And it's just, it's amazing what God has created. And yet, what was his most important thing? Us. Acts 17, 24 and 25. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He didn't need us. He didn't need anything. He has it all. He can create it all. He can do whatever he wants. But yet he chose to do that. God created us for why? His own glory. That's why we're here. And then if you're like me, you step back and go, Okay, I'm created for your glory, God. How do you wrap your mind around that? What does that really mean? How do you put wheels on that? And that's probably the wrong term. But how do you make that real? What does it mean that we are made for his glory? It simply means that we are important. We are the most important because in Genesis chapter 1, he set us to rule over everything that he was to create. It is for that purpose. Isaiah 43 verse 7, God says, everyone who is called by my name, thank you, Debbie, for fixing my typo there, because otherwise this verse would not have made sense. But everyone who is called by my name and whom I have created for my glory, that's why God has created us. 1 Corinthians 10:13, here's the why. Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So how do we glorify God? We're to serve one another. We are to serve his body. It's not about us, even though if you're like me, I fight that every day. When I get up in the morning, no, this is my day. This is about me. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to have. And I go on my merry way, and usually God lets me go there, but sometimes it gets a little painful when he says, yeah, you're not going there. And I think you're probably in the same boat. We fight that. But God created us for his glory. So if that is what he intended to do, then what is our purpose that comes out of that? Our purpose must then be to fulfill the reason that he created us. We're to fulfill the glorification of God. We're to take joy in God and our relationship with him every day. And how many of you do that every day? I don't. There's days it sometimes doesn't even enter the cranium up here. It doesn't even get there, you know. But we're to take joy. And there's days I don't feel joyful. There's days I'm, don't ask my wife, but there's days I'm disgusting. There are days that are rough. And I know you guys have those too. We all do. We're human. Because we live in a fallen world. But God created that. He knew that. Revelation 13:8, I believe. The cross was created before the foundation of the world. The cross was planned before the foundation of the world was ever laid. Think about building a house. Where do you start? You got the dirt work and you've got the preparation and you pour the foundation. So as God is doing that, the cross and Christ have already, they're already there. It's already known. It's all put in place. We're still days in the future. But God chose to do that. And he wants us to take joy in that. And he knows we're going to struggle. We're going to have days that aren't our best days. But he wants us to take joy in him and in that relationship. And this is the most important part. John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Christ said, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Thou shalt not murder. Where does that come from? The thief who intends to kill and destroy. Satan is the root of that. But Christ says, no, I came that you may have life. And when you read that, you may think, well, Lord, where's my Maserati and my $2.7 million house on a lake? No, That's not what God's talking about. None of you, I guess, would ever drive a Maserati. Yeah. One blew me off a road in California a couple years ago. And I was like, wow. But Christ said, I came that they may have life. And that life is the joy in that relationship with God, whatever it is that he's given us. And some of us deal with incredible pain. Some of you have got messed up backs. Some of you have got coming out of cancer surgery. Others have other kinds of things. But God said, I came that you may have joy and that you have it abundantly. Maybe you're getting over a heart attack or whatever other things are out there. But we're to take joy. I talked about Corrie Ten Boom in her last years, and God gave her the task to pray. And all she was able to do was lay in bed. She couldn't talk. She couldn't do anything. She was totally invalid. And yet her task was to pray. And she struggled with that. But she learned to have incredible joy about what her prayer ministry was doing. Psalm 16:11. You will make known to me in the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand there are pleasures forever. That's how God wants us to see it. So in conclusion, to sum all this up, God clearly states biblically, thou shalt not murder. And he gives us ample evidence to that fact of why we should not do that. He truly desires a relationship with us, with those whom he has created, and he desires that we fulfill that purpose in glorifying him. Wayne Grudem, in his book Systematic Theology, says, and I probably should have had you put this up there, as has been discussed in this message, that God desires people of every race deserve equal dignity and rights. This means the elderly, those seriously ill, the mentally ill, and children born and not yet born deserve full protection and honor as human beings. If we ever deny our unique status in creation as God's only image bearers, we will soon begin to depreciate the value of human life. We will tend to see humans as merely a higher form of animal, and we'll begin to treat others as such. We'll also lose much of our sense of meaning of life. And I think that pretty well sums up kind of where we're at. Because we've been, as I talked, as you looked at that photo, who murdered the gorillas, as we begin to change the words and the meanings and about what is life truly, then things begin to fall apart. So what's the so what? I think we need to begin to pray more earnestly than we ever have for the soul of our nation, for the soul of our churches, and our fellow man as never before, that God would move through this nation and revive us as only he can do. Let's call the worship team back up. Let's pray.